Hurricane Dorian takes aim at Florida. The Duval County School Board lawyers up. And a look back at 10 years of local politics as we celebrate 10 years on the air. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join us. Get on the line now. It's 549-2937. Then later, it's Summer at the Cummer for a few more weeks anyway. We'll speak with Cummer Museum CEO Adam Levine. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week with some real busyness to come in the next few days, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal is here. Hey, Tim.
How are you doing?
Freelance journalist Claire Goforth joining us.
Good morning.
And regular contributor Charles Griggs.
Good morning.
So good to have all four of you here, everybody, and lots to discuss. Later, we'll talk about the Duval County School Board's lawyering up in their fight to get a half-cent sales tax before the voters. We'll also take a look back at 10 years of local politics around town. But our top story right now, Hurricane Dorian is taking aim at much of Florida this weekend and into Labor Day. Forecasters say the storm could be a Category 4 when it makes landfall south of here. We're not sure exactly where Dorian's going to strike on the east coast of the state, but it could be anywhere between Miami and Melbourne. Governor Ron DeSantis joined Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry yesterday here in Jacksonville at the city's Emergency Ops Center to sound the warning and encourage everyone to be prepared. We may see evacuations around town over the weekend, but the mayor says that depends on how the storm develops. We're beginning the show with a closer look at what we can expect from Dorian and also looking back to the flooding we experienced 2 years ago after Hurricane Irma. Could we see that again? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Well, even before Dorian makes landfall, high water, it's being reported, Dan Scanlon, could be a problem. In Northeast Florida, the National Weather Service has issued a coastal flood advisory for Nassau, Duval, Clay, St. John's, and Putnam counties. There's a high tide out there. Flooding is a big concern.
We've got what's called a near king tide, which means all the planets are in alignment. And so we're already seeing some high water. A firefighter buddy of mine said this morning that the Pottsburg Landing boat ramp there on Beach Boulevard already had a high water. And if you remember Irma, 2 years ago, the wet sports there was surrounded by water. They had kayaks from their stock floating inside. Your first sign is going to be, to me, is going to be watching if the river starts bubbling up through the manhole covers in San Marco. That's where the water is so high, the river is pushing itself through the storm drains and coming up on the streets.
That's a good bellwether to watch out for. Yeah, unfortunately, Claire, San Marco is one of the neighborhoods in our community that still hasn't even fully recovered from Hurricane Irma's damage and flooding.
No, I mean, there are a lot of people around Jacksonville that haven't recovered fully. I think of Ken Knight Drive, you know, when they had such terrible flooding and it just took months and months and months of recovery. I know that they have made some strides. There was some money for some dredging that came in through somewhat controversial means, but there are so many things that Jacksonville needs to do looking forward to deal with resiliency with hurricanes. I mean, we can't just keep sticking our heads in the sand and say that we went so many years without a hurricane when now we will have a hurricane in some way. It looks like 3 out of 4 years.
Yeah, 549-2937 to join us, Charles and Tim. That's right. We've had Hurricane Matthew, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Michael west of us in the panhandle. And now here comes Dorian.
There used to be a time when in this community we could look to certain areas just to flood. Now those areas are very unpredictable. And that is the problem here because hurricanes now, we're thinking more of damage control. You know, how can we get lights back on and services back together? But it's the flooding that really causes the most concern now with here in this part of the state, because it's been, you know, the last two hurricanes we've had, we've seen a significant amount of flooding that's caused a lot of damage.
Yeah. Tim Gibbons, you know, we've got two task forces, committees in Jacksonville looking at how to adapt to future flooding, how to become a more resilient city. And these are comparatives that are becoming more urgent all the time.
They are, and arguably we're more urgent and we're somewhere behind the curve. Well, you look at some other cities in Florida who have moved ahead much faster. I mean, even just, you know, down in St. John's County, there seems to have been a longer track record of of preparing, of making the city tougher, of making it more resilient. I know we're talking about politics later in the show, but it's an interesting political question. The city is not part of the Rockefeller Center's Resilient Cities program, which it had been a part of and we got pulled out of.
Mm-hmm.
It is a question of whatever you believe. You know, if you believe the scientists who study climate saying that there's climate change, or you choose to reject that, it's clearly an issue that Jacksonville is dealing with, and it creates huge infrastructure problems. I mean, during Irma, there were parts of downtown that were shut down for days, and if you're trying to grow a downtown, if you're trying to do business downtown, it's difficult.
That's right. How are you preparing for Dorian? What are your questions, concerns? Give us a call, 549-2937. Now, speaking about the politics of this hurricane, Dan Scanlon, Floridians are also noting that the White House has diverted FEMA funds in the hundreds of millions to the southern border and the migration crisis there, and it diverted those funds away from disaster preparedness in places like here, where people are still waiting, actually, years after Matthew and Irma to even get payouts from FEMA. So that is controversial as well.
And the funding has already been diverted, or some funding's already been diverted to Puerto Rico because of what they mm-hmm. faced a few days ago. There had been something I read this week that said, even with the diversion of money to the wall, there was sufficient in FEMA to assist if there wasn't a major disaster. Well, watching the Weather Channel this morning and seeing we could get 10 to 20 inches of rain, that this storm is going to be slow moving and dump a lot, and it could be shoving water around the river. It does concern me. We're seeing an Irma-style event coming maybe by Wednesday, Thursday.
Let's hope not. You know, the one thing we've all learned, too, from covering all of these hurricanes is there's always some unpredictable X factor. We can sit and try to prepare and prognosticate, but we simply just don't know
where
the storm's going to go and what unexpected impacts it could have.
And when Dan talks about the slow-moving bit, that is going to be the interesting X factor here. Not just where does it make landfall, but how long does it just dump rain? I mean, the big fear of hurricanes is always the wind tearing your roof off sort of thing. But particularly with the flooding that Jacksonville has had over the past couple of years, that much rain, it's not going to have anywhere to go.
Mm-hmm. And the conversation also goes to how much control do we actually have over, you know, how we deal with these storms. We know that these are natural occurrences, but what is it that we can do to sort of help mitigate these occurrences from happening?
Bomb them, obviously.
In the midst of all this, we're hearing this reporting that the president inquired several times if he could nuke a hurricane.
I think he only inquired.
He later said that was a lie, for what it's worth.
But I think he only inquired about nuking it during one conversation. The other ones, he just said bomb it. So, I mean, bombing it's probably fine. I mean, right?
And that's a joke for everyone sitting at home.
It's just the nukes that's the problem.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Now, here's another one we really need to talk about. This was a huge story this week in Jacksonville. The Duval County School Board has lawyered up. This after the city council voted 14-5 Tuesday night to withdraw the school board's proposed sales tax bill. So the board fired back. They've hired high-powered attorneys Hank Cox, Audrey Moran, and Scott Cairns. They'll keep pushing through these pro bono lawyers to get the referendum before the voters. Meanwhile, the city of Jax ordered the board to cease and desist from this path. And the board is basically telling the city to go pound sand, as the mayor likes to say.
Or fill sandbags.
And so, as we talk about this, and Dorian, we want your calls at 549-2937. These stories are linked in the sense that public school buildings are hurricane shelters. So one of the reasons why the school board is pushing so hard for this money to shore up school buildings is for the safety and security of not just students and teachers, but the public too. Claire.
Yeah, because the hurricane, they're required to be built to certain hurricane specifications. But I mean, I'm not surprised that the school board has lawyered up. Quite frankly, I'm surprised that the Office of General Counsel has the audacity to think that one firm essentially can represent two opposing parties in a dispute. That is a clear violation of Florida bar rules and conflict of interest. And it's just, it's put a lot of bad taste in people's mouths, because it looks as though the Office of General Counsel is functioning as a tool of the mayor's office, and then the mayor's donors, who are big charter school proponents. That's behind all of this is how much money are the charter schools getting? And they're having, I mean, the school board, it looks to me like because they want to base the funding on the same formula that they base public school funding on for improvements, the per foot, you know, per square
foot. The school board is saying we want funding per square foot.
Right.
The majority of the council is saying they want per pupil funding.
Right.
That money should go, should follow each individual student, whether they're in a charter school or a public school.
So the money would benefit the few and not the many, essentially, if on the theory that charter schools have larger facilities with fewer students. Does that make sense that we are going to take a minority of students and give them more funding? I mean, all students deserve an excellent education and to be in a facility that's safe and is, has all of that it needs. But Duval County Schools are in a situation where they have some serious infrastructural issues to take care of, and we're all mincing words about how much money we give charter schools.
Okay, let's also note, with that, I want to not leave out our listeners in Clay County. They're looking at a similar confrontation there, where the Clay County School Board is at odds with the Clay County Commission over this kind of funding for school facilities.
Well, the question, I think one of them, the big question here is, how did we get here? I mean, this is something that's supposed to be routine, where the school board passes along a referendum to be put on the ballot, and the public gets to decide whether or not that referendum is valid or not, if they accept it or vote it down. And that's the question. What's happened here is that we've, you know, especially Tuesday night, we was culminated in some high drama. I mean, I haven't seen.
Oh yeah, let's talk about the fact that the president of the city council, Scott Wilson, threw the public out of a public chamber. He ordered everyone out because there were some unruly people in the crowd booing the city council,
including school board members,
including
journalists.
Yeah, he threw out school board members, media, Senator Audrey Gibson. Simply extraordinary. Some people were eventually allowed back in. Channel 4's Jim Pigott stood up for the free press and our democracy and said, you'll have to arrest me if you're going to throw me out of a public meeting. This is really quite extraordinary.
It was 30 years ago, the last time we had this type of high drama, when then Council President Tilly Fowler had to have Councilman Denise Lee and Warren Jones and Deidre Mix put out warrants for their arrest. They haven't brought back into
because
the council.
Because they left the city council meeting in protest over.
And one was dragged out of the ladies' room.
That's right.
And weren't they protesting? Doesn't
the budget.
This,
they were protesting the
but
budget.
But they were protesting allocations of the budget to
for
minority
their particular districts,
neighborhoods.
That's right.
Yeah. So really, honestly, like so many of the stories we talk about on this show, that's the subtext, whether it's 30 years ago or today, for those that really get deep into the roots of this. The school board is trying to divert more funding to poorer schools, older schools, and schools that have majority minority students. So like so many other issues in Jacksonville, this comes down, in a sense, to race.
When you look, you know, down in St. John's County, where they put the issue on the ballot, it was voted no mess, no fuss. St. John's County is always pointed at by people in Jacksonville from an economic development standpoint of, you know, that's the place where when you have executives come in, you talk about the school district because it's a good school district and it helps bring people here. And the push has always been make sure that Duval County, you know, has that level of school district as well. But they're able to pass the tax. You know, it just went through as you know, as a routine matter. And the idea that there's this amount of drama, I don't think was something people expected.
The thing that's blown me away is how city council has essentially taken on the role of being in charge of this project. I mean, they are asking questions about where money is going and how the school board is doing this. And really the only question that they should be asking is when is it going on the ballot? That is the limited authority that they have according to the opinion issued in Clay County. And yet we see council people asking really specific questions about where money is going does the school board going to now start weighing in on matters of the city budget? Why do we even have a school board if city council is trying to circumvent their role?
That's the controversy
that
is if you perceive that the city council and the office of general counsel has undermined this school board's independent authority, which is why they are now retaining these lawyers, particularly raising eyebrows, they've retained Hank Cox, who is one of the most prominent criminal defense lawyers in the state. And so can their legal eagles move the needle on this, I think, is what people are wondering now. Where is this going to go?
Well, the general counsel fight's interesting. As somebody who, you know, enjoys Jacksonville history, and you look at how the charter was set up, the idea of having the general counsel be that final arbiter, you know, is kind of baked in, but baked in a sense that the general counsel does not work for the mayor. You know, he's not the mayor's attorney. He's not even the city's attorney exactly. He's the everybody attorney. He's supposed to be, he or she is supposed to be somebody who is apart from the process. You know, if you look back at the discussions when that part of the charter was written, it very much was, you know, you get somebody of keen legal insight. You get the expectation was somebody who's not a government employee so much as somebody who comes in and serves this term for a while and can make these type of impartial judgments. And that's not the view I think that people have of the general counsel's office now.
Also, in the past, when you've come into situations where the authority that feels like they're not getting the type of representation they need, or they need a second opinion, the general counsel's office has granted waivers for them to get outside counsel on certain situations. And the problem here is that he hasn't granted that in this situation for the school board to get outside counsel. So
right, because the independent authorities have had fights with city government before. I remember one with the airport several years ago over Cecil, and it was, okay, you get your own lawyer and we'll work this out. And, you know, like Claire says, you can't represent both sides in a dispute.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. And let's go to some calls now on our Friday roundtable. We're talking about the hurricane. We're also talking about the escalating fight between the city and the school board. It's 549-2937. Jessica is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I was wondering if, because many of these charter schools rent or lease their buildings from private owners and sometimes faith organizations like churches and synagogues, would any money dedicated to charter school building repair essentially go to help private owners' buildings?
I think that's the question that has come up in this debate. Supporters of charter schools have said, look, you know, we've had to fight for funding. We are a scrappy upstart kind of community. Critics of this have said, well, the majority of these buildings are leased. So in effect, you're directing taxpayer money to landlords. Is that fair? Is that an appropriate use of tax? I mean, I think that gives you a sense of the controversy.
Well, so from a business standpoint, the idea that if charter schools are public schools, which they are, the idea that they should be funded by the public, just like the traditional public school, you know, it is the case that charter school supporters make. And then you get to, well, they have to have space somewhere, and either they own a building or they lease. But, you know, when the school board buys portables, that goes to a private company. So, you know, there is an internal logic to what they're saying. Once you accept that first principle that a charter school should get the exact same funding that a traditional public school does.
Well, the pushback on that is that charter schools come to the table with a business plan, and they have to live within the means of that business plan. If they have a facilities plan, they are the ones doing the long-term planning for that. Whether they're in some of these charter schools are owned, they have multiple facilities. They're owned by a charter management organization, and so they may have the resources to facilitate their own private facilities or have multiple locations. They come to the table with a business plan, and they are supposed to be able to carry that plan out without any additional support, only the per pupil funding that they receive from the state.
And in the midst of all this fight in Duval County, we need to note that a 3-judge panel of the First District Court of Appeal found this week, ruled regarding a law, a controversial 2017 law that established and funds a new charter school system. This decision essentially, I'm going to simplify it a little, it paves the way for the further blending of the funding streams for charter and district schools, okay? Choice advocates have long wanted this. Critics of this have panned it. They call it the privatization of public schooling. They've also accused pro-charter forces in the state of trying to, through 1,000 cuts, effectively dismantle traditional public education over time. And so this fight in Duval County is really at the center of what we're seeing also play out around the state of Florida. This really intense fight in Jacksonville is a microcosm of what we're seeing in the state.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we're seeing such high drama. I mean, this is literally a clash of philosophies of, do you think that public education should simply be the traditional public school systems, or do you want parts of it privatized? Because if you're going,
but they're still getting our money. That's the thing with privatization. And we're seeing it not just in the schools, we're seeing it in prisons and other areas. Right. And when there's this thinking that we want to take our money, our taxes, and give it to private companies because they can somehow do it better. But we sacrifice oversight and we sacrifice the actual facilities themselves and some of the property. So in the end, if these private companies close, they can sell that property that we've spent millions and millions of dollars improving and just use it for whatever purpose that they desire.
Right, that idea that schools can be hurricane shelters, they're a dual-use thing, and a privately owned charter school doesn't have that responsibility. Now, sure, there are enough hurricane shelters, we don't need more of them, but you know, to your point, they're public facilities, and we own them, we pay for them as taxpayers. There is the irony that charter schools' argument has always been, let the free market reign, you know, let us come in, we're not going to be burdened down by all of this public bureaucracy, but we want the public money.
But what's next? And free market police, free market firemen? I mean, at some point we have to ask ourselves, isn't this better under the public purview?
We saw how well that worked in RoboCop. And that's seriously, a private corporation running law enforcement, and it did not work too well.
Let's go to Mika in Arlington. Hi, Mika. Now. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I just have a quick comment. When your guest was talking about FEMA funds being diverted, he mentioned that the funds were diverted to, well, part of those funds were diverted to the border wall, and then he mentioned that the funds were also diverted, used the term diverted, to Puerto Rico. And I just wanted to clarify, not to split hairs, but the funds assigned to Puerto Rico for hurricane relief, those funds are not being diverted. They're being appropriately assigned.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I appreciate that call. Thank you, Mika. Thank
you
for
that. Yeah, did you see that thing the other day about someone saying that they need a new president of Puerto Rico and people did not realize that they were just talking about the actual president of the United States?
Linda is in Deerwood. Hello, Linda.
Hello. You guys have brought up great points this morning. One, if they're going to get public funds for the charter schools, then we as the taxpayers need the mandate. You're the newer facilities, then you will be the hurricane shelters. Because who wants to be sheltered in a older building without air? This really goes back to consolidation. I think we need to file a class action lawsuit for every student since consolidation, because part of that was, if you give up your power, we will give you these things. And because most of these schools are on the north and the northwest side that are being starved to death to give private companies profit. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. Either you're all in or you're all out, and let's sue them into the ground to get them to pay attention. Thanks.
Thank you, Linda. You know, the argument that the people on the side of the school board have made is, yes, these are some of the oldest school buildings in Florida. Air conditioning doesn't work a lot of the time in some of these buildings. Some of them are actually literally crumbling and just need serious shoring up. That, and now she made a serious comment as well about thinking parents and students need to file a class action lawsuit. Several other callers have brought that up to this program. At this time, it seems that the school board thinks they have more standing than individual parents or students might have to pursue this legally. I'm not a lawyer, but that's what legal experts have told this program, that I guess that has been discussed internally, but this is the strategy that they're going with.
What would have been the council's approach had this been a conversation about curriculum, or had this been a conversation about transportation, or anything that the school board has purview over? This is something that has boggled the mind, why at this particular point for this particular referendum that there's so much controversy. Some folks have argued that because local communities have now found a way to address situations that are not occurring, underfunding that's not occurring in Tallahassee, that this is a way to disrupt it. But because we have seen over the years, the legislature has begun a slow walk backwards for defunding public schools, traditional public schools, in favor of charter schools. And with that being said, you know, they have to find money somewhere. They cannot sell things. You know, they can't go out and create a Duval County Public Schools store and sell, you know, T-shirts on the side of the road. They have to find funding somewhere to address these issues. And because of that, this is a way we've seen it in other counties. You mentioned St. John's County, Hillsborough County did it just last in 2018. In fact, they passed two referendums, one for transportation and one for school facilities improvement on the same ballot. So this is something now that many people see it as a way to disrupt this process of increasing funding for those needs for traditional purposes.
But I think you're supposed to push control down to the local level. Isn't that the idea that you don't want Tallahassee controlling everything? You want the local government to be
action? I think some of the things I've heard in the community is that if the city council is interested in supporting charter schools to this level, then A, they should either lobby Tallahassee and get more funding for them on that level, or B, pass their own referendum or raise the millage rate to deal with it on their own.
It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a comment about charter schools. So in my experience, and I've had my child in St. John's County Public Schools, Duval County Public Schools, private schools, and now he is in a charter school in Duval County. And I've also been a very vociferous critic of private prisons, because clearly that has been a failure. But with regards to private charter schools, at least in this area, or public charter schools, I'm sorry. Yeah, I do believe absolutely it's unequivocal that they do a much better job than any public schools in both Duval and St. John's County. And it is a very diverse population of students, and what is different than in the public schools, in my experience, has been that diverse population of students is protected and valued in a charter school, unlike what our experience has been in public
schools. Which school do you have your child in now?
I have my child in Seaside Charter School,
okay.
And they have opened three campuses now.
Yeah, and you know, parents who have kids at Seaside have called into the show several times and sung its praises, Susan, so I appreciate that call. And so for parents out there like Susan, they appreciate the option to enroll their child in a different kind of education model, mm-hmm. like Seaside.
And there are parents students attend Stanton and Douglas Anderson and Paxson who will say the same thing. But there are charter schools out there that mirror what you see at some of the underperforming public schools, as traditional public schools as well. So we haven't really seen a clear line of delineation around quality in education among the two different fractions.
That is part of the problem with comparing charter schools to traditional public schools, that there are absolutely amazing charter schools out there. But like any you know, business enterprise, you're going to have people who come in and do an amazing job and have great customer service and have high quality products, and you're going to have people who are in it for a buck. And you know, I would posit that a lot of the people who are leading the fight to get more money for charter schools are not doing it out of a money grubbing. They just want money. They're doing it because they honestly and truly care about the kids. But the question is, what about the people who are downstream who don't have that and they are just in it for the money?
It's 549-2937 as we discuss the biggest stories of the week here on our Friday roundtable. Perry is on the east side. Hey, Perry, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just had a comment. As a taxpayer, I feel that I don't want any of my tax dollars going to a for-profit charter school. I think it's ridiculous that a for-profit entity is taking my tax dollars away from the public schools. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Perry. And that's why I think we've seen such acrimonious debate on this. You just heard from those last two callers, the divisions in this community and in this country over this issue, how we educate students, how we pay for it, where the money goes, who has the power, who gets the money. We're watching this play out in real time in the most dramatic fashion here in Jacksonville. And so, you know, it's not surprising that we would get these kinds of calls today in the midst of hurricane prep, by the way.
Well, you know, the elephant in the room right now is the fact that in a week, you may be talking about the damage that occurred to Duval County Public Schools that are already deteriorating due to the hurricane. And then I'm sure there's a contingency emergency fund in the school district to pay for that, but that's just more more stress and strain on the physical plants that are out there.
Stephanie in Middleburg. Hey, Stephanie, good morning.
Good morning, and also congratulations on 10 years.
Thank you.
I just have a quick question about, the buildings that are, the roofs are, you know, falling apart and they're deteriorating and the ACs aren't working. Has a building inspector gone and done reports on these and the buildings that aren't up to code? Wouldn't that be an automatic, some sort of like law or something that those buildings have to be updated per code?
Well, I mean, certainly we've heard the school superintendent talk about this as the storm season ramps up, the importance of keeping these buildings to code as storm shelters.
The superintendent has stated that when they get, when they receive work orders for, repairs, they go out and take care of them. And that even if they don't get the money, they're going to do the best they can. They're going to make it work. So in the interest of educating the kids, the students, they're kind of, you know, doing this with, you know, duct tape and bubble gum. You know,
and what I wonder about sometimes in this debate is what's the end game of the charter school advocates? Is it that all schools are charter schools?
Well, there's been discussion about that. I mean, from what I understand and what I've heard is that there is talk about this Nouveau County being one of those charter school districts or having a charter school district.
Where, so, and I've heard that too. Like people who are not liking this trend mm-hmm. have expressed that they perceive that that is the backroom agenda to charterize much of this county. And now, you know, proponents of charter schools, charter school operators will deny that, you know, vehemently. They'll say, no, that's not what we're trying to do here.
What are they trying to do?
You have multiple players involved in this. So it's not, you know, one charter school company is trying to take over Duval County. But again, I mean, it is a free market sort of thing. If every charter school is trying to grow as you know, large as it can, at some point, just as a de facto thing. They're all fighting to get as much market share as they can, and mm-hmm. they're taking that market share from the traditional schools.
Your news partner, WLRN, did a story report on this whole charter expansion and how Jefferson County is pretty much 100% charter school.
Right, and there's only three schools in that whole county, by the way.
Yeah,
kind of place, but yeah.
They have one CMO there, Charter Management Organization, but that district was used as sort of like the training ground for how they would develop the legislation for schools of hope, and looking at how entire districts or the majority of a district can become a charter district.
Yes, and so yeah, so is Jefferson County, Florida, a bellwether for what, or a test case, perhaps?
And will a charter
for what we may see in other counties in Florida as this fight plays out in county after county?
And will a charter school operator or operators buy the existing Duval County school facilities? Because they're going to have a tough time, if that occurs, trying to build new schools.
Lou is on the north side. Hi, Lou. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I would like to express my disapproval for taxpayer dollars being used for for-profit schools. It's my understanding that when the taxpayer dollars are used for construction of for-profit schools, if that school should close the year or so after that, those profits, those real estate, go to the for-profit organization. And I do not think that that is a good arrangement for taxpayer dollars to be used for profit of other people.
Lou, thanks for that. Here's an email from Ricardo. He says, hovering over all of this is the Republicans' fear of putting this to a vote and having the less government, less taxes myth lose at the ballot. St. John's is super conservative, and we still voted for a sales tax increase because we appreciate the need for good schools. Yes, greedy charter operators. Yes, there's animosity to public school teachers and unions. Yes, racism and classism all play into this. But the fear of showing their ideology is a lie is also part of this.
I think that's the, you know, to your point of the Hillsborough County passing, you know, education and transportation. There is that question of how you attract people, how you attract businesses, how you grow an area. And the ideology that Jacksonville prefers is low tax and you know, but by making it a you know, by using that as our calling card, we will attract people who want to be here.
And not taking an opinion on that listener's email, but I do want to bring it back to the spectacle we saw Tuesday night of mm-hmm. the public being thrown out of a public city council meeting by a body that that group perceived was thwarting the will of the majority of the residents in this community, who polling shows want this to be put on the ballot, want a chance to weigh in. It's looking like it will certainly not be on the ballot this year. The push now is to get it on the ballot next year.
You know, I have covered city council off and on for 30 years, and we've come close. They've come close to telling people it was time to leave. They threatened it when there's been many, many groups, usually wearing the same color T-shirt or button, supporting some item. But it never got to this point. I vaguely remember maybe the room was cleared once during a committee meeting some 10 or 20 years ago. This was unprecedented. And then to only allow the media and a few school board members back in for a vote when the people out in the lobby, out in the other meeting rooms, I'm told some did not have audio or video to watch. At what point does that become a Sunshine Law violation?
Right. The city had argued the video stream was up and running. Some people who attended have told WJCT it wasn't up and running for the entirety of the time they were voting. That does appear to be a clear violation of the Sunshine Law, if that's true.
Yeah, I've spoken with people who said that they have absolutely no confidence now in their elected officials, people who represent them, especially, you know, some people thought that their urban core, I would say District 8 and District 7 representatives would have voted differently, Jacoby Pittman and Reggie Gaffney, and really thought that that was disappointing and think that that was, you know, could not have been listening to the constituents in a situation like that. And people are very disappointed. But at the same time, they believe that nothing's going to happen until something actually happens. So somebody's going to have to take some action in order for things to change.
Melissa is in San Jose. Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I'm so glad to have this conversation.
Sure.
So I just wanted to make a comment. My son actually goes to a charter school, River City Science Academy, mm-hmm. Because we have no good school systems in our neighborhood. Love that. I'm from Tallahassee, and I just want to comment about the Jefferson County, how they went to all charter schools. So that's right outside of Tallahassee. My brother-in-law taught there, and the school system was failing, and they could not bring their grade up. They were an F school, D school, could not. They were given the ultimatum, you have a year to get it up. They could not pull it up. My brother-in-law, as a teacher, was told to not push the kids hard. Don't push the kids hard, because it's going to upset the parents, and the parents were complaining, you're pushing my kid too hard. So the school system had to close. They were given no other choice but to close. Now comes the charter school. Guess what? They're being taught. But it's because the school systems would not allow the teaching to happen. And so they were given no other choice but to close, because they couldn't bring up the grade.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. Thank you for that.
And I think it's
and she's right. It was a failing school district, small county, only a few schools.
It's important to note the fact that we've underfunded public schools for a very long time. And if we had been fully funding them to the point that they need, where we don't have overcrowding and we don't have these infrastructural issues, we'd be in a little bit different situation with some of these failing schools. This is a long trend where we just kept cutting and cutting and cutting and refusing to increase the funding, and at the same time increasing all this testing and things like that take away from the enrichment of the classroom experience. And that's where you end up. I mean, definitely some things need to change, but we have to take a look at our own role in this.
And I'm so glad she called and pointed out that that county did have a completely failing public school system. In Duval County, we are essentially graded at a B overall. There are pockets of failure, pockets of excellence, and decent performance elsewhere. So we aren't a failing school district. I just want to make that clear. Duval isn't, I want to say.
Right. And as the parent or a grandparent of a child in a public school on the South Side, we're very happy with the way he's being treated. So just a little thumbs up to a school is only as good as its administration, and especially its teachers, many of whom put their own money into making sure that each day is really good for their kids.
Yeah.
Okay. I think one of the questions about the charters also, and I mean, this really centers around choice. And if you're a parent, you got to figure out what's best for you. But we're talking about the difference in accountability. And one of the arguments has been is that the charter system does not offer the type of accountability that the traditional public schools offer. And so we don't get to peek all the way under the curtain to see behind the curtain to see what's really going on in every instance. And I would argue in some cases in Jefferson County, from what I understand, is that a lot of the discipline problems were dealt with differently than they are in the traditional public school setting. So if you're able to remove all of the students who are challenged, guess what? You're dealing with just
that's certainly one element to it. Yeah. Okay. So all this week we've been marking the 10th anniversary of this program with a look back at trends in town across the last decade. We've looked at business, food, arts and culture. Today we're focusing on politics. So panel, when we started this show, John Payton was the mayor. John Rutherford was the sheriff. We were looking at a city that had not yet passed its updated human rights ordinance. Those are just a few observations. What are some of the biggest political changes that you've observed in this community over the last 10 years?
You know, my opinion was John Payton initially was a business guy, a businessman who became the head of the city. He impressed the heck out of me as he would do his town meetings. He would take questions. He would answer them. He really did learn quickly. I think ultimately that was my biggest takeaway from that administration was he and his gang really did learn how to handle the city well. Leave it at that.
I would say the election of Alvin Brown as mayor because we had our first African-American mayor. The way that happened, we had two people in the race who folks thought would be great mayors between Rick Mullaney and Audrey Moran, who didn't make it into the runoff, which was surprising in his own right. And then to have Alvin Brown run against Mike Hogan, who was at the time what everybody considered to be a Tea Party conservative, and Jacksonville really pushed back against that. So
that was a big deal.
Deal at the time. As wonky as could be, but the entire pension system changed. At the time when you talk about starting 10 years ago, and God knows how many programs you had that talked about making pension reform interesting on the radio, could not have been easy. But whatever you think of the referendum that was passed, the idea that we are in a different space and the Police and Fire Pension Fund Board and administration is very, very different than it was 10 years ago.
Good point.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the AHRO extending those protections to the LGBTQ community was one of the highlights of the past 10 years news-wise. Probably one of the lowlights would be the arrest and ultimate conviction of Congresswoman Corrine Brown.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those are all big moments over the last 10 years. And I just want to thank all of you and all of our Media Roundtable participants. From the very first week, we have devoted Friday to the Media Roundtable, and it is our most popular hour of the week. And that is because of you guys. Oh. So thank you so much for consistently joining us and making it so lively and interesting. We really appreciate it.
And unlike your first guest, we got here on time today.
That's right.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Dan Scanlon, Tim Gibbons, Claire Goforth, and Charles Griggs. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Hey, Melissa, it's Claire Goforth. Happy 10th anniversary, the wooden anniversary. I know you're very excited to get a bunch of blocks from all of the city officials that you've been holding accountable like a boss for 10 years. Keep on rocking.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and of Arlington remind you that water damage can happen fast. It is important to assemble a disaster supply kit. ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington at servprojacksonvillesouth.com, like it never even happened.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Times Union Media and J Magazine will be hosting a J Event panel discussion on September 24th at the River Club. Guests will enjoy lunch while networking with downtown's most prominent advocates. TimesUnionMedia.com/events for more information.
400 years ago this summer, the first enslaved Africans arrived in what is now the United States. One family in Virginia believes it can trace its ancestors back to the first slave ship.
We built America. We built this country off the sweat off of free labor. We built the capital. We've invented so many things, so many resources that everybody uses every day.
Their story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, a person has died from a mysterious illness linked to vaping. It's hospitalized hundreds of people in dozens of states. What we know and don't know about this illness, plus new science lessons from the great minds of the Science Friday Educator Collaborative. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
The number of Democratic presidential candidates is still in the double digits, but the pool continues to shrink. President Trump is taking questions about hosting world leaders at his resort near Miami, and Barbie celebrates her 60th birthday with a tribute to some inspiring women. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is Fred Matthews wishing a happy anniversary to First Coast Connect, hosted by Melissa Ross, one of the treasures of Jacksonville.
Thanks, Fred. So are you. Thank you for that. All right. Finally, this hour. Summer at the Comer is coming to an end, but there is still plenty to experience at the museum and gardens in these final weeks of summer. CEO Adam Levine is here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So much happening at the Comer Museum, but let's begin with the big thing hanging over all of us right now. Hurricane Dorian is bearing down on the state. At the Comer Museum and Gardens, you just completed an amazing restoration of the beautiful gardens that were essentially destroyed by the flooding that Hurricane Irma left behind in its wake. So this is not good timing, unfortunately, to kind of spread the word about the gardens being restored if we hopefully won't face, but could face, some more flooding. So what's the Comer Museum's plan for Dorian?
Well, Mother Nature obviously doesn't always want to cooperate, but we learned a lot of great lessons from Hurricane Irma. And in our reconstruction, took great efforts to harden the gardens by relocating electrical, hardening irrigation. We are also going to be putting in a temporary wall, a temporary seawall, using an innovative technology called the Tiger Dam.
What's that?
So it is basically inflatable Kevlar that you fill with water, and it will provide an extra 3.5 feet of coverage. The debris line from Irma was at 4 feet. So we are preparing for an Irma-like storm, and this was all provided for in our reconstruction budget. We also, given that the water table doesn't always want to cooperate, we will be installing pumps throughout the garden to be pumping water out that may come up from underneath. So we have taken great efforts to make sure, in addition to all of the standard gardening techniques, removing fragile flowers, making sure that loose things are tied down. So we are going to do everything that we can to make sure that these reconstructed gardens stay reconstructed. And even though the weather may not cooperate, we will be open this Friday for summer at the Comer, for Summer Fridays, rain or shine.
Rain or shine. With a little luck, we'll just get a little wind and rain here in Jacksonville.
That's the hope.
Well, yeah, it sure would be a shame to see all that work that you put into the gardens go to waste. So it sounds as though you've been extremely proactive, which is very good news for the fans. And I'm one of them.
Thank you.
Gardens at the Comer Museum. So Friday night, you've got Summer at the Comer, Summer Fridays. What else is happening?
Yep. So Summer Fridays run through September 6th, courtesy of PNC Bank. And those have been so unbelievably successful. I think on your website, you'll be putting up some pictures. Between 750 and 1,000 people every night, open from 4 to 9 p.m., and it is totally free.
Free?
Yeah. There is a charge for the French Moderns exhibition, but those gardens and the permanent collection galleries, as well as all of the programming activities, are available for free.
Yeah.
French Moderns, the exhibition on Impressionist and Post-Impressionist chest painting and sculpture runs through early September. We have, by popular demand, extended it to Sunday, September 8th. And in the middle of that run, we, of course, have our free Tuesday nights, courtesy of Florida Blue, and one more free first Saturday, thanks to the Weaver. So lots of free opportunities to see the museum and to see that show before it closes.
I would encourage everyone to go see the French Moderns exhibit. It really is stunning. If you've never had the chance to see these incredible Impressionist masterpieces, now's your chance. So go and see it while it's still here. And before we let you go, summer's almost over, but you're a new CEO. You've got a lot of new ideas, new initiatives. There's a lot happening in the fall as well.
There
right?
is, yeah. So we're very excited. We'll be kicking off our new fiscal year with three really important things I think your audience should know about. So the first is we are coming to the completion of our family-to-family membership match. The objective is to raise, to have people purchase 5,500 family memberships, which would allow us to give a membership to each of the 5,500 entering DCPS fifth graders. We are three quarters of the way there.
Really?
And we have until the end of September. So any of your listeners who are not yet family members, consider joining. You have until the end of September. We will be kicking off the exhibition season next year with an exhibition on Louis Comfort Tiffany. Yes, that is the same Tiffany as in Tiffany jewelry.
Yes.
But he was also a pioneer of glassmaking and stained glass windows. He was a painter. He was a polymath. And this exhibition focuses not just on any one of those media, but on his entire output and how he was a great innovator. And that complements the reinstallation. And this third thing is the reinstallation of our contemporary galleries, which looks at innovation and imagination in 20th century artistic practice. And I'm really proud of that exhibition. Our curatorial team did such a great job because that exhibition, the artists therein are totally representative of the demographics of Jacksonville.
So much happening at the Kummer Museum. Well, let's get through this storm and then get out and enjoy it. Adam Levine, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's our show. We'll be tracking Dorian all through the weekend and into the Labor Day holiday with the help of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Keep it tuned to 89.9 for regular updates. Thanks, everyone. Have a safe weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.